episode 151 of Breaking Tape with Butter and Barry. I am your host, Jeff Bowdrin, full of pertinent details, hopefully this week, that will amuse you. Barry, in fact, check downstairs. Will it titillate you? Maybe. Barry, are you titillated?
Jeff, I'm always titillated. Just hearing the word titillation gets me all titillated.
That's a good word. Well, Barry, what is your favorite word?
I do like the word moist for some moist. Reason. I don't. Moist,
what is your least favorite word?
I think jazz. Something about jazz just sounds, I don't like the way it sounds. I don't like the word jazz.
Like jazz hands?
Oh.
Ties directly in with something on our show today. I was going to go with vomit, which maybe people will do after we talk about this match. I don't know. So we've got a very interesting show for you today. Oh, Barry, we've got a special, special guest star. We went to Hollywood last week, of course, with Pleasant Gaiman. This week, we're going Hollywood part two. And this one, may I say, directly hooked up by Mr. Barry Rose. I appreciate your efforts, sir. As we are going to talk to one of my favorite character actors of all time, a guy we had a great time chatting with. Barry, could the guy be any more humble?
He couldn't. He couldn't be any more humble, any nicer. He literally is the guy that you want to go out and have a beer with, or, you know, get some chicken wings with, because he's just so easygoing. He's so friendly, so nice. And I think, you know, in my conversations with him, I think we've made a real friend for the show. You know, that's how cool is that?
Yeah. And we are talking, of course, about the veteran, distinguished character actor, William Sanderson. You know him from Newhart. You know him from Blade Runner. You know him from Deadwood. Good Lord, he's E.B. Farnham. William Sanderson, great character actor. And we had so much fun talking to him. Such a nice guy. We're going to be playing our interview with William. We are going to be having our match of the week. Now, this is an interesting one, Barry. It took place on February 29th of this year. And shockingly, this would have meant that it took place probably about a week before the whole COVID thing struck. We are going to Chicago. It is Jim Cornette and Brian Last's favorite wrestler, Kenny Omega, and the Hangman, Adam Page, taking on the Young Bucks from Chicago and the pay-per-view that took place there. Now, what's interesting is I recall when this match took place that none other than Dave Meltzer, friend of the show, former guest of the show, I thought he was quoted as saying this was one of the greatest matches of all time. So I reached out to the Meltz and I said, did you say this was the greatest match of all time or that this was one of the greatest tag team matches of all time? And he said, well, I don't think it's the greatest match of all time. A little clarification there. He says, but I do think it's one of the greatest tag team matches ever, up there with the matches between the four pillars in All Japan, which would, of course, be Kawada, Taue, Kobashi, and Misawa, along with, the Hansen and Dr. Death and Terry Gordy stuff. He said it's up with those All Japan matches from the 90s. So Barry and I will be offering our commentaries on that. So that should be fun. Before we get into the body of the show, I think that's the first time I've ever referred to it
as the body of the show.
Body. It's a hell of a nice body, too, if you know what I'm talking about, Barry.
Yeah.
A couple of things we want to address. First of all, a bit of sad news. And I know, Barry, that you want to discuss this. We learned just the other day of the death of a good friend of the show's, a good friend of yours personally, a lady that I had the chance to meet, I think on one or two occasions. And I'm going to tell a story after you're done talking about her, Barry. That is the late Belinda Luttrell Romano. Such a nice, nice lady, the daughter of Cowboy Luttrell, the founder of Championship Wrestling from Florida. Barry, share with us your thoughts on the death of Belinda.
Yeah, I was really brokenhearted about this, and I have no problem admitting that I shed a few tears when I got the message. Jeff, is the story that you're going to share our dinner? Or should
yes.
I incorporate? Okay, so I'll leave that out. But in a nutshell, so, you know, if you've been listening to this show or just following me in any aspect, you know that my passion is championship wrestling from Florida, a wrestling territory that has been gone for over 33 years at this point. But it's something that, you know, is near and dear and close to my heart. And about 5 years ago, I reached out to Belinda. She did not know who I was. And I think I sent her a friend request on Facebook and she didn't accept it. So I kept canceling and resending it, you know, trying to get her attention. And she finally accepted it. I explained who I was and what my mission was. And we became friendly based off of that. And, you know, and it's one thing, you know, in our Breaking Kayfabe Facebook group, it's for the most part, it's almost anything goes. You know, we have a couple of rules, Jeff. One is no politics, no religion. The other one is, Jeff, no
assholes.
No assholes, exactly. But for the most part, you know, we're pretty loose. Things can happen. The CWF group is different. It's what I call a respect group, and that we respect the legends. Even if, you know, look, even if a guy wasn't a great worker or a good wrestler, and certainly we had them in Florida occasionally, we do show respect. And a lot of the reasoning is we have a lot of family members and a lot of the workers themselves. But we, you know, we have the granddaughter of Mike Graham's daughter. And Belinda obviously, you know, joined us about that time, about 5 years ago. And so I explained who I was, what I was about. We became really friendly. And I would often hear from Belinda sometimes 2 and 3 times per day because she would find something and she would want to share it. So, you know, it was a friendship, I think, born out of love of professional wrestling and CWF. But at the same time, she understood that I wanted to preserve and archive as much as I could of CWF. And she was really on board with that. So we invited her to be at the first ever fan fest that we did. And we were honoring both her father, Clarence Cowboy Luttrell, as well as Eddie Graham. And we were honoring them. We got the Hillsborough County Commissioner to issue 2 proclamations, essentially making it Cowboy Luttrell and Eddie Graham Day. And they gave us these proclamations and we were able to present these to Belinda and to Nicole Gossett, Eddie Graham's granddaughter. And it was a really special moment in the fact that, you know, the typical fan fest, so something that, and I've been over this multiple times, but what really bothers me about a typical meet and greet fan fest, and Jeff, you really don't go to many of these. It's a money grab. It's, you know, it's designed to see how much money we can take from your wallets and your pockets. And that's it. You know, you can meet, let's pick Ric Flair, and you can meet Ric Flair. It'll be $60. I guess it's $100. You'll get an autograph and you get to take a photo with them. And the entire experience with Ric Flair for $100 is probably going to be 2 or 3 minutes max. You know, I would say it's probably 2 minutes max at that point. And for some people, that's absolutely fine and that's acceptable. But for us with the fan fest, that really wasn't what our goal was. And our goal was not only to give fans a great experience where you could rub elbows and have a conversation with somebody like Jody Hamilton, the original assassin, or Ricky Steamboat. But the other aspect of that was to honor the people who laid the foundation for the shit that we care about. And in doing so, being able to honor Belinda's father and Nicole's grandfather was a really big deal. And I understood, you know, from my aspect, and again, I'm very emotionally tied to CWF, so I'm probably not the greatest example because of that emotional attachment. At the same time, it meant so much to Belinda. And I heard from her on a date. She was so nervous, Jeff. I've only had two people that we were ever going to be at a fan fest be nervous. And one was Belinda. And she was so nervous that she would call me and say, I don't know if I can do this. And I tried to tell her, all you have to do is just say a couple of words about your dad. We'll take care of the rest. And look, I was nervous too. You know, we hadn't started doing the podcast yet. I wasn't a public speaker. It was our first fan fest. What could go wrong? Everything could go wrong, right? So even I was nervous, but I kept Belinda calm. There was a lineup of interviews that she did for the Tampa Bay Times, the Miami Herald, which was great because, you know, obviously we're spreading the word of the fan fest. But at the same time, and it's kind of like, you know, we've been doing this virtual Hall of Fame in the CWF Archives group for years. And at the end of the day, you know, it is what it is. It's a virtual Hall of Fame voted on by fans. It's not a legitimate Hall of Fame in the sense that there's not 4 walls. It's not a brick and mortar building. But with that, a lot of people voting are knowledgeable. To that end, and where I'm really going with that, this proclamation meant the world to Belinda. And, you know, again, we're at a fan fest. We're at a, it's our first one. We're in a building that could have housed wrestling in the 1940s. I mean, you're talking that building. Remember that original building, Jeff?
Yeah.
It was as old school as you can get. Like that, yeah. That was literally like as old school as you can get. And there's 125 people in here, but it meant everything in the world to Belinda, to the point that, you know, 2 and 3 years later, she would still bring it up and how important it was. And that really means a lot to me, you know, to know that something like that means something to her. So we had a friendship, and I would say about a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago, Belinda wasn't in contact as much as she had been. And I was messaging her and reaching out, but I wasn't getting a response. And at the same time, she hadn't posted anything. So I reached out to her son-in-law, who I'm friendly with, and he told me that she was in long-term rehabilitation, eventually got moved to a hospice facility, but she had had a series of minor strokes and she was not doing well, but they were hopeful that she would improve enough that they would be able to get her back to her home. And unfortunately, that never happened. She continued to have health, and she had health issues when you and I were, you know, when we met her and hung out with her. But, you know, it was really devastating. She was a very sweet woman who, in a sense, had been dealt, you know, a bad hand health-wise in her later years. She had a very supportive husband, Steve, that you and I had both met. And, you know, it was one of those things where she had been removed from professional wrestling for 40, 50 years, something like that. And through our efforts, we brought her back into something, and it was a comfort zone for her. And I was really, that's a really important thing for me right there, that we were able to do that. So I stayed in contact with her son-in-law, and I would check in on her every month, you know, month and a half. And he would just say, you know, Belinda's not doing great. But I never got the impression that she was terminal and going to be passing away. And unfortunately, and I believe it was last Thursday, he reached out and he said that Belinda had passed away overnight. And I was just devastated. And I think partly she was a very sweet woman. I mean, which you know, you're going to tell a story. She was a really sweet woman who wanted nothing in return from you. And, you know, she legit, you think of kind, this was a human being who was really kind. And I really, you know, I really treasured my time with her. Like, it was just one of those, I really cared and I really treasured my time with her. And I was really just devastated that she passed away, even though I knew she wasn't in good health. And her funeral is, I think it's this upcoming Thursday. It is this upcoming Thursday. Unfortunately, I can't go. I'll be in Pittsburgh on that day taking my son back to college. But I was going to get in the car and I was just going to drive down and go to her service because that's how much I cared about her. She was that sweet of a woman and she was that good natured. And, you know, I can't say enough good about her. And she is, you know, she is a link. She was a link to history. I mean, you know, her father created championship wrestling from Florida. He was the guy who did it. It's, you know, he's the guy who fought Jack Dempsey. So she was the only child of Cowboy Luttrell, and she was a legitimate link to history. And, you know, it if anything, it makes me want to continue what she was trying to do, you know, and she had gone through all of her photos, and there are these amazing photos that have never been seen before of Cowboy Luttrell in the office, the CWF office at 106 North Albany. And it just, you know, it just was devastating. I guess I was, even though I knew she was sick, I was just so caught off guard. Such a sweet woman, Jeff. And I'm happy that you're going to tell this next story, because that, especially in hindsight now being, you know, over three years later, it's just very special. Very, very special.
Very well said, Barry. Just a lovely, lovely woman. As I said, I did not have the opportunity to know her as well as you did. The day of the fan fest, my wife had come down with us, and she and Barry and myself and my wife, and I believe it was Bruce Cohen and her husband, all decided that we were going to go out to Burns. We were going to meet at Burns Steakhouse. Now, if you haven't heard of Burns Steakhouse in Tampa, it's legitimately one of the finest steakhouses in the entire country. And, you know, I'm not talking Longhorn here. Okay. This is an upscale steakhouse where, you know, they literally, you know, roll out the red carpet for you as their guest. And it's a real high class place. And so here we go to Burns Steakhouse. And, you know, very, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but it's a very old school restaurant. You know, you go in there and you know, this is not a place that opened up 2 years ago. This is a place that's 40, 50 years, Barry. How long has it been there? Do you even know?
Oh, I think it's even longer than that. The guy's name that opened it. So it was in the 80s before you had a fine dining restaurant explosion, which would have occurred towards the later part of the 80s into the 90s. Burns Steakhouse was considered top five restaurants in the entire state of Florida, if not the top restaurant in the entire state of Florida. And if you went to Tampa, if you did not go to Burns Steakhouse, it was like saying, you mean you went to Orlando and didn't go to Disney World? Yeah, it was that kind of a deal. So it's been around 40 or 50 years. The guy's name was Burn Lasser, and he's long since passed away. But Jeff, everything you're saying is correct. What an amazing experience.
And to the point where I recall that my sister and her daughter, who lived in Jacksonville with her husband, who has since passed away from lung cancer, they, as a surprise for his birthday, flew him from Jacksonville to Tampa, didn't tell him where he was going, and they surprised him by taking him to dinner at Burns Steakhouse. That's how well thought of Burns was in the state. Restaurant community, like, you know, that my sister flew her husband and daughter from Jacksonville to Tampa just to go to dinner at Burns. Didn't spend the night. I think they flew back later that evening. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it was a pretty special deal. And her husband knew what kind of special deal it was. So anyway, let me continue. So we go there. Just a tremendous, this is not a restaurant experience, Barry. This is a dining experience.
Yes.
Because not only do you have the restaurant itself where you get the finest steaks and stuff like that, then you go in and they have their the wine room. And I'm not a wine drinker, okay? You know, I know there are people out there, that's just not my deal. But to say that the collection of wine they have in their wine room will blow your socks off. If you've never had a sip of wine, you will be impressed by this wine cellar that they have. It's just absolutely, it must be 20 rows of bottles of wine, and it must be a good, 20 yards deep. It's just an amazing collection. And then you go upstairs, and they have their dessert room where they cook desserts that will make you sorry that you had that much to eat for dinner, because the desserts are just amazing. Well, the reason I'm telling all this is, so here she was with Barry, who she had, had you met her face to face before this evening?
No, physically, I had never met her.
Okay. I mean, you had talked to her online. My wife and I were meeting her for the first time that day. I believe Bruce Cohen was meeting her for the first time that day, and her husband. They treated us all to dinner. Okay. And again, this is not Longhorn where you're paying 15 or 20 bucks for a steak. I mean, this is a serious 75 to 100 for a steak. Am I right, Bear?
Oh, yeah. Easy.
Yeah. And everything is, as I recall, everything is a la carte. So like if you get a baked potato, that's another 15 bucks. And they picked up the tab for us. People that she barely knew, because she was such a nice woman and she was such a classy lady. And unfortunately, I have to tell you, in the wrestling business, meeting women of high class is not something that you always do. They're out there, but they're few and far between. I mean, quite frankly, men of high class in the wrestling business are few and far between, but they are out there. And Belinda Luttrell Romano was a woman of high class. She was a lady. My wife, Kim, and I will speak for Bruce Cohen, who's not with us, were deeply appreciative of the fact that she treated us to dinner. Three people that she didn't know, that she had never even talked to until the event that day. She is such a lady that we normally raise an adult beverage to her memory. However, because she's such a lady and I don't know if she drank, Barry, I will raise a nice glass of ice water to the memory of our friend, Belinda Luttrell Romano.
Yeah, that was such an amazing evening. And I remember we were at the hotel, we met, and I think it was yourself, Kim, me, and Bruce, and then we all went together, and we met Belinda and her husband at the restaurant. And the restaurant also has a strict dress code. No sneakers, and I think everybody has to wear a jacket, right? Wasn't that it?
Maybe it's a jacket or a collared shirt. It's one of those.
Collared shirt. There was something, but no sneakers was the one that I remembered. Yeah. And we sat down, and you're right. Everything's a la carte. And when you said dining experience, Jeff, you were 100% correct, because we were probably there for 2 to 3 hours. It's a very staggered, slower pace of service, but you're never wanting for it. It's not like you're sitting around waiting for your food. They do everything in very metered out courses. And that was a great experience. The good news is, Jeff, I actually just looked at my phone as you were talking, and I have a photo of the wine room that I took that day that there I'll be posting. Yeah, I'll be posting that in the group. And the dessert room was great. And I clearly fucked up in this dessert room, because by the time we got to the dessert room, I was the only one who didn't get dessert. And I love dessert, but I couldn't eat. I don't think I ate till like dinner time the next day. But I'll tell you, one of the memories that I have of that night, Jeff, is that what seemingly looked like a real friendship between Belinda and your wife. And they were just talking amongst themselves like, you know, two friends that have known each other for 30 years. And I never forgot that, how they were just sitting there just having conversations. And it had nothing to do with professional wrestling, obviously. They were just having conversations, and I just thought that was great. So I will absolutely miss her. I am regretful of the fact that I didn't get to spend more time with her or talk to her more, but I'm also really grateful for the time that I did have. So with you, Jeff, I am raising a bottle of water at this moment.
There you go. Okay. We will miss you, Belinda. Now on to more less important matters, shall we say, Barry, for the purpose of this show. Quick note, Barry, on the very rare political discussion since I brought it up a couple weeks ago. Barry, I mentioned the pending election for clerk of the court in Broward County. My old boss, Brenda D. Foreman, and the somewhat controversial Facebook post where she had the picture of someone who was supposed to be Hitler and had a quote that was attributed to Hitler that was not actually Hitler, that she got in a lot of hot water for. Barry, Lou, she got reelected. She got reelected, and it wasn't close. It's just absolutely amazing that she got reelected. What in the God's name is going on in Broward County, Florida? I don't know. I'm so glad I don't live there anymore.
It's first off, it's Florida. So that always seems to be the patent excuse whenever something. But I won't get into a political discussion for the audience.
No. And I didn't want to either.
No, I know. Yeah.
Because, you know, I brought that up as a rare political, just because the candidacy was going in such a bizarre direction. And I just wanted to follow up and let the listeners know that she had, in fact, continued to run despite the post. And won. So she's going to be.
Question? What was the turnout for this? Are you privy to the numbers of what the turnout was?
You know, I'm really not, but I can tell you that historically, not just, I won't say just in Broward County. I know in through most of the state of Florida, I don't know how it is in Pennsylvania with you, Barry, or out in California with Lou. Primary season is not the election that people turn. Yeah, you get 20% of the voters turning out for that. And it's a big deal. I think more so when you're talking a national election, whether it's presidential or you're talking about senatorial election, that's where you're going to get more people showing up.
Sure.
And so this was a very small turnout because the only the people in this race were all running on the Democratic ticket. There's no Republican challengers for the seat. So she's in. She won the Democratic primary. She is now back in. I mean, unless somewhere in the next literally like a week or two, someone decides to run on the Republican side of the ticket, which historically Broward County is not a stronghold for Republican candidates. I think of all the elected, think about this, of all the elected officials in Broward County, I literally think there's one or two that are Republican. It is a Democratic stronghold. And it's amazing because you literally go north of, say, Palm Beach or maybe Jupiter, and it becomes a completely different state. You know, I always say there's two states. There's South Florida and there's North Florida. And people don't realize that, I saw something posted a couple of weeks ago. Oh, Florida's not part of the South. Well, apparently you've never been to the, the northern part of Florida or the panhandle. It definitely is part of the South. Anyway, Let's go on to other things, Barry. I wanted to give a quick shout out to our listener, Justin Pratt. Justin, I posted something on Facebook about, you know, Barry, as I've detailed my struggles with cancer and with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I received a really, really nice note from Justin. I asked him for permission to use his name. Justin contacted me through Facebook Messenger and said, you know, I have been listening to you detail the struggles that you've gone through with your cancer and your chemotherapy and stuff like that, and told me that he had detected some swollen lymph nodes, I believe in his throat, and was concerned about it, but had not gone to the doctor. After he listened to me discussing my trials and tribulations with cancer and with chemotherapy, he made the decision, made the call, went and saw his doctor. And at the time of this recording, he had not yet got the results of his biopsy. But it really touched me, Barry, that he told me, he said, I basically did this because of what you talked about. And you were the inspiration for me to go to my doctor and get this looked at, which I really meant a lot to me, Barry.
I would have to. It's, you know, again, Jeff, if I was to ask you, if we go, we're almost at 3 years in doing this podcast. And if I was to ask you, go back 3 years ago and things like this, this never would have popped in your head, right?
No, not at all.
Exactly. This is what, and this is what's really important. At the end of the day, we can talk about jazz hands and all that other shit, and it doesn't mean a goddamn thing. And here you've got a guy, you know, he's a young man, he's got a family. And because you shared your story, you talked, you know, your dedication to wanting to live, Jeff, he went and got checked out. And that really says something right there. So I get goosies. I get goosebumps when I hear about something like this. So Justin, we are obviously all in your corner, and we are all optimistic that this is you know, not something that is going to you know, it's not gonna be cancer. We're all in your corner on this one.
Amen to that. And before we get to our match of the week, Barry, I do want to mention that I believe the person on our Facebook page was Mark Small, who's been with us for quite a while on the Facebook page, who made the suggestion. Here we are at episode 151, and Barry and I are proud to announce, along with Sweet Lou, the chef, that in episode 156, our third year anniversary of doing this show, 156 episodes, Barry. Jeez. And we are pleased to announce that for the first time in the history of this podcast, we are introducing a Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Hall of Fame. Yes! Yes, Barry, it is long overdue. We will be giving out what we call the Kayfabies. Yes, it's award time. Barry, that's are you awesome. Psyched for this?
I am. And a little bit of controversy with this one, and what? I'll tell you why. I believe this idea was broached 2 or 3 years ago, and it was either John Doe, Travis Raines, or Aaron Grafton, but one of them brought up about doing something like this. And I think, you know, I think at that time we were still trying to get our,
I don't want to give Travis credit for anything, Quentin.
I know you don't. I know that. But it really is a great idea. And I can tell you the brain trust here, and I don't think anybody would ever refer to you and I as brain trust.
Very loose interpretation of that term.
Very, very loose. And with Sweet Lou's involved, that's the only reason there's a brain trust here. But we are coming up with some kayfabe, some awards. And I think this is going to be a lot of fun, Jeff. I know that I was up at 3 a.m. last night going, you know what? We should give this guy an award. I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
And I think we can safely announce that we will be having some guest appearances, no extended half an hour, in the 3 to 5 minute range. Some people that have been with us in the past are going to rejoin us, perhaps to say a few words, maybe to get a small token of our appreciation, but that should be lots of fun. So whether it's Mark Small that we need to thank for this idea, or those other two whose names I've already forgotten, this is going to be a fun idea. I think we're going to have some fun playing around with it. Now it is time, Barry, for us to go to earlier this year, pre-COVID. It was just a splinter in the mind's eye at this point. Something going on over in Asia. We didn't know anything about COVID yet, Barry. February 29th of this year in Chicago, it was Kenny Omega and the Hangman Adam Page versus the Young Bucks. Was this the greatest tag team match you've ever seen? Or was it even close? Barry, tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, and I want to say I was in Las Vegas on the 20th.
You are Mr. Vegas.
I was Mr. Vegas, and I was in Caesar's Palace. I was there for work, and there was some discussion of COVID, but it wasn't any, you know, and again, you're in Vegas of all places, which would be like a petri dish for COVID, but it wasn't where anybody was wearing a mask, obviously, or anybody was overly concerned. You know, we were all taking planes to get out there. And then, of course, within 2 weeks, by the middle of March, everything had changed. And we're still continuing to see that change. So it is. It's unbelievable because as I'm watching this match, realizing it's earlier this year, nobody's wearing a mask. You know, there's a lot of people here and they're all jammed in together. So this is a very good match. Is it the greatest tag match I have ever seen? I don't believe so. Is it a great tag match? It absolutely is. And, you know, so I guess this is the part, Jeff, where we address about Jazz Hands and the Young Bucks, what cosplay wrestling, all that stuff. Let me clearly say, I like AEW, but I don't put on glasses that blind me to the reality of life. And I watched, Jeff, I don't know, did you watch this past Saturday? I think it was at 6:30.
As a matter of fact, I finished watching it about a half hour before we started taping.
Oh, beautiful. We could talk about this too. So it was bumped by about a half an hour because of the NBA playoffs. And I started watching it. And I got to tell you, I was underwhelmed at the show on Saturday night, which is the first time I haven't been overly impressed with AEW. For the most part, I do enjoy what they do. Yes, there's some goofy shit in there, but it's still, you know, comparatively speaking to a lot of other wrestling that's out there, it's still far superior. You're going to find a bunch more trash on, you know, the WWE, not NXT, but on Raw or SmackDown. I liked Impact a lot. There was a great tag match. Jaworski now cranking it, as I say, Impact. But there was a great tag match, which was a return match for the Impact World titles between the Motor City Machine Guns versus the North. And it was out of this world. And I think when I go into AEW, especially at this stage, my expectations are high because they have put on some great matches. The tag match I'm going to get to eventually was fantastic. But I was underwhelmed with what they presented on Saturday night. And I realize it is, what was it called, Jeff? What was the name of the special?
You got me on that one. I tell you what. Why don't we talk about the tag match, and then we can talk about AEW. Did you happen to watch any of the WWE stuff from this weekend? I know they did an NXT show. They did the Survivor Series or something.
You're worse than me. SummerSlam.
SummerSlam. I'm sorry. You're right. I knew it began with an S. Okay. Don't be so critical.
I didn't. You know, partly was I think I canceled my subscription because for a bunch of reasons. But I got to tell you, in reading about both shows, there was the twinge there where I was like, fuck, I kind of wish I would have seen it. And SummerSlam did sound like it was good, but no, I did not see it. But let's talk about this match. You're right. So we're looking at the Young Bucks versus Kenny Omega and Hangman Adam Page. Now, I have been, I think I'm very honest and I'm truthful. I'm not trying to impress anybody. I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid. This is strictly my opinions on this one. Fucking Adam Page went from, in my eyes, non-existent to a main event player. And he's just, pardon me, I'm burping now. I'm so excited. He's a complete package. He is literally, I'm not seeing any flaw in his game. I love his entrance. I love the way he comes out. He looks like he's ready to come out and fight. He seems all, you know, wound up tighter than a snare drum. I love that whole buckshot lariat that he does as a finisher. I think it's great. But everything he does, it just seems to work. And I'm such a fan of this guy. The Young Bucks, and this is such a polarizing topic. Little kids, and I'll say this, Jeff, you and I both started watching our wrestling when we were young. We were both in our preteens, you know, or our teens, and we were young. And a lot of those memories will stay with us for the rest of our lives. And there are a lot of our listeners that look back on the WWE. And this is, you know, I get it. You know, we rag on Kevin Nash all the time. But a lot of people that you know, that like Kevin Nash or at least intrigued by Kevin Nash, grew up watching the Kevin Nash. They were young. They were 12. They were 13. They were 15. So to them, this was a big deal. You know, seeing Kevin Nash versus Shawn Michaels, greatest match of all time, which you and I clearly don't think that way. But to them, maybe it is. There are people watching the Young Bucks right now that, A, it's their favorite tag team. But at the same time, a lot of these kids are going to grow up and they're going to look back 20 and 30 years and say the Young Bucks were the greatest tag team of all time. And the Young Bucks are fucking incredible. Again, I've been watching wrestling since 1971. So, you know, am I an expert? No, I'm not. I don't know who's an expert. But at the same time, I do have a little bit of credibility in the fact that I can compare because, you know, whether it's videotape, whether it's on television, whether it's somebody I saw live, I've seen wrestling now for close to 50 years. And I got to tell you, the Young Bucks are an incredible team. With that, this match was good. Kenny Omega, and you brought this up. I don't know, was this last week or the week before, Jeff? I think it was 2 weeks ago. And you said it. Kenny Omega has been massively underwhelming in AEW. And even though he was good in this match, to me, he's still, out of the four men in the ring, he's the least impressive. And when I say that, he's the one that just doesn't leave me going, holy shit, did you see that? And I think, you know, again, I saw his New Japan stuff. You can hate on him all you want, but his New Japan stuff was absolutely out of this world. I'd have to think he's being restrained right now and possibly by himself for a future run. I think he would do much better as a heel, not this tweener character that he plays, but I think as an out and out heel. But we'll talk about the matches. I do it. So the referee looks like Voldemort from Harry Potter. who in God's name was the referee? I mean,
I don't know, but now I'm going to think of him as right.
The first thing I'm doing, I'm going, oh my God, he looks like a zombie. You know, like, who's this referee? Nick Jackson does a succession of moves and flips that's incredible. And he takes out both Hangman Page and Kenny Omega, and literally he'll do a flip or whatever on one and do. And it was about four or five in a row, and I was just blown away. Adam Page, I'm going to assume he's about 5'10. When we saw him at Ring of Honor, he was right near us. I think he was our height. He's obviously, he's not in quite as good a shape as you and I are in, Jeff.
Wow. Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, he did a moonsault off the top rope, the top turnbuckle, onto the floor and landed on his feet. And
that was pretty impressive, I have to
really
say.
It really, really was. His body isn't built for that, and you can see it. And what was cool about it, when he landed, there was, like, no stumble either. Like, he fucking just landed. That was incredible. Matt Jackson does three suplexes in a row on Page. The first is in the ring, and it's in the ring, but he suplexes him, and it's kind of like a fisherman suplex, but he's not hooking the leg, but he does the suplex onto the ring ramp. Then he does two more. That I thought was incredible. The finishing maneuver, though, of the buckshot lariat and the V-trigger, and the V-trigger essentially is Kenny Omega's knee. That is a hell of a finisher for those two. Every time I see it, I think it's fantastic. So this was a really good match. The match goes, I'll say, what, 30 minutes, Jeff? Is that about right?
It's something along those lines, yeah. Because I know when I sent it to you, it was like 40 minutes.
Right.
And I told you, I said, don't worry, 5 minutes of it is the walk up and 5 minutes is the when they're leaving the ring. So
yeah, and I think I texted you and I was like, Jeff, 41 minutes, go fuck or something like that. And then you replied and told me and you said, yeah, you can take 10 minutes off of it. But you know what? If this match had been, see, and this is what I think a lot of the problem with the WWE is, they obviously don't give these guys a lot of time to tell a story. This match, beginning, middle, and end, this match told a complete story. I thought it was fantastic. Again, not the greatest tag match I ever saw, but, you know, if you were to ask me to name 10 other matches, 10 other tag matches that were better, I don't know if I could. This is probably the best tag match I have seen in a long time, though, and it was really, really good. To that end, it's a shame that some people will not watch this match because of the participants, because at the end of the day, you're only cheating yourself This is high quality professional wrestling in the year 2020. Look, I miss the territories as much as anybody. We talk about it all the time. I used to go to wrestling, Jeff, twice a week, sometimes three times a week, live wrestling, and I saw it. This is completely different than anything you and I ever saw back in those days. But the beauty of it is we can miss the territories. We can appreciate what's currently going on.
Let me just say that, you know, you're right. There are people in other groups that automatically will just be dismissive of this match, whether it's because of the Young Bucks or Kenny Omega. It's funny. People don't feel that way about Hangman Adam Page. And whether that's because his character is getting over or whether that's because he's not one of the quote unquote executives with the company the way the other three are, I don't know. So as I started watching this match, and, you know, the problem is when you have a match that you know is this well thought of, a lot of times you go into it and you're like, okay, if this isn't like basically close to perfection, I'm going to be disappointed. And so I had very high expectations for this match. The first, I want to say 10 minutes or so, they were doing some different moves. And one of the things that was, I don't want to say bothering me, but I thought was negatively impacting the match to that point was the whole, these guys are friends. It's just their competitive nature that they want to face off with one another. And I found myself thinking, you know, one of these teams either needs to be a heel or they need to be, you know, somebody like Jim Cornette or JJ or Gary Hart or somebody standing at ringside, getting ready to hit somebody with a shoe, you know, to have some sort of drama involved in the match, you know. And, you know, we've watched matches like, say, Dory Jr. versus Jack Briscoe, where you have a 35-minute match, just as an example. And for 30 minutes, nobody would do anything the slightest bit underhanded. It was a straight match, very clean. And then right as Jack Briscoe is coming back through the ropes, Dory punches him in the gut as he's walking through the ropes or something like that, just a very subtle thing. And that sort of turns the match from being very good into great. And I kept waiting for that moment for somebody, you know, not necessarily to turn, but somebody just to do something slightly underhanded, you know. And then the match at some point, I remember at the 15-minute mark, started picking up the pace a little bit. And for all those people that say there's a lot of flippy shit and the jazz hands think, you know, you were right when you talked about, I'm sorry, was it Matt or Nick that did all the different spots where he took the hot tag that
well,
you mentioned?
I think it was Nick.
Okay. Right. And he sent both guys flying a couple different times and it was very impressive. And the problem is in between all this really impressive stuff that they do, there's nothing where the match just kind of slows down. You know, it's like they go outside and they'll take a little break outside to catch their breath, you know, slap a headlock on somebody and, you know, take it down to that and work some chain wrestling on the mat. That's all I'm looking for. Just something to slow the match down a little bit to make us appreciate these incredible spots that you do, because they do incredible spots. You're right about Adam Page. I think he is, I'm going to put this out there. I think he is a part of the future of the company that maybe people don't realize is part of the future of the company. I'm not saying within the company. I'm talking about people that watch it. They don't realize that this guy's going to be a really big deal, I think, over the next year, because I think he's really going to explode, because people are, you know, whether it's kind of a ripoff of Steve Austin with the beer and all that kind of stuff, you could say that, but he's doing the ass kicking babyface who really doesn't give a crap. And it works so well for Steve Austin, and it's working very well for Adam Page, because, you know, like you, the first time I saw Hangman Adam Page, I was like, why is someone doing a Hangman gimmick? That just seems like so 70s, you know? Yeah. And he's got the buckshot lariat combined with the V-trigger, which is a great finishing move. I will have to say, I think for people out there that are looking for a match that's going to top this as a candidate for match of the year, you're going to have to look pretty long and hard. And we've only got about 4 months left, and it's really going to take something to top this. Because, this was a pretty damn good match. What happened is after that initial 10 minutes where I kept kind of waiting for something to happen, the last 15 minutes of this match I thought were really hot. And by the time it finished, I was like, wow, this is a pretty freaking good match, man. Like, I was pretty impressed. And I thought all four guys really gave it their all. And the crowd, let me just say, the crowd is really missing from, I'm sure, not just the AEW shows. I'm sure that the stuff that they're doing in the WWE, whether it's NXT or the WWE, SmackDown or Raw, they miss the crowds, you know. And this crowd was white hot for this match. And really, this was a case where the crowd and the crowd reaction added something to the match, I felt like. And so, this is one I can definitely, definitely highly recommend. I know last week's match, Barry thought really sucked. I don't think we got the same opinion on this one. This is one I will post in the group, and I would encourage you to check it out. And this is good stuff. So before we move on, Barry, let's talk, since we both have had a chance to watch the AEW, let's talk about a little bit about where AEW is going here. Now they've had a little over, God, how long they've been on TV now? Is it a year or 2 years now?
I think it's almost a year, isn't it?
Okay. And really, they're starting to put their stamp on different things. Let's talk. You said you weren't a huge fan of the show from Saturday night. Let's talk about some things that I thought were pretty good. I thought the Brody Lee Cody thing was very well played, as just a finish out of nowhere, and then the basically the annihilation of Cody and Arn. Now, that Arn thing is something they can't do. You can't beat up Arn because he's a babyface manager, and I don't think that's someplace they can go a lot. I think that's got to be a very limited thing where somebody puts their hands on Arn. What'd you think of that?
Yeah, it does. It's not something that you want to do on a weekly basis. I think that's got to be once or twice a year max when it comes down to it. I guess it was designed to get Brody Lee over very strong, because essentially it was a squash match. There wasn't much to it. I guess I was underwhelmed at the way the show went. I don't know. It's just something didn't hit me. But a lot of people are agreeing with you, Jeff, in that they felt that was the right thing to do in getting Brody Lee over.
Well, and again, if Cody is going to chase Brody Lee, we've spoken about this before, it's always better to have the babyface chase the heel. We talked about that, I think, with John Moxley and MJF. By the way, great bit with MJF and the attorney that's representing him. I don't know where they found that guy, but he did a great promo.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
And Moxley did a great promo before they went to that. So that's and I think what's going to happen there, I'd be very surprised if Moxley doesn't win the belt somehow. I'm sorry, if MJF doesn't win the belt and Moxley begins the chase. Now, let's talk about something else that you and I privately have talked about. I think that you actually had a pretty good idea when we were talking after last week's show or whenever we talked about how underwhelmed we were about Omega, and we were talking about it off the air. And you said, well, I think that eventually the game plan is that Omega will turn and go back to being a heel. And I think after what happened on Saturday night, I think the seeds were laid, and I'm going to tell you why. I think the seed was laid with Kenny Omega kind of being out of control after their match with the Young Bucks, and the Young Bucks having to calm down. By the way, did you see the guy? He did the running jump onto the chair, and the chair kind of slid off Omega. And I know it's part of the angle, but I was sitting there going, oh my God, I bet that had to hurt like shit. I can understand if he legitimately was pissed, because that looked like it was brutal. The other thing is that there was something when FTR was in the dressing room and Adam Page went in there, and they were doing the interview, and Tully was kind of standing off the side. Did you catch what Tully said at the very end?
I saw it, but I don't know if it registered the same way.
He said, "Fear the." It wasn't the retribution. Oh, I think he might have said, "Fear." Lou, help me out with this. If you've seen it, it was something like "Fear the retaliation" or something. And it wasn't what I was expecting to say. And I've been around this too long to think that somebody said something that was a mistake that they didn't catch. But I think there's going to be a play where Omega is going to become part of the FTR and Tully Blanchard group, and that's who Hangman Page will be fighting. And, you know, you said it, and I don't think that, and I really hope they don't bring up the Bullet Club thing again and make it a Bullet Club East, you know, like United States version. So I think the end game is that Omega will turn heel on Page, making Page even a stronger babyface. And I think he's going to align himself with FTR and Tully Blanchard. What do you think?
So that would make FTR, Tully Blanchard, and Sean Spears. And I think there's been at least chatter, whether it's accurate or not, that this would be a reformation.
Oh, in God, some please form. Don't say it. Don't say
you know it. You know where I'm going.
So I'm tired. Please don't. You know, I saw some guy today on, I don't know if it was the Mothership or some other group, who said, you know what they ought to do? They ought to have Barry Windham come out with Hangman Page. I don't know if it's Hangman Page or somebody else. And that way they have three members of the Horsemen that are back, and then they could form a new horse. And he came up with some new idea for the Horsemen. And I was just like, good Lord. Oh, please, can we just put that group to rest and put a tombstone up? I'm so sick of the Horsemen. That, you know, they did that gimmick fucking, how many years ago? 25 years ago. And people keep talking about reforming the fucking Horsemen. God, let it fucking die already, you know?
Oh, I fully agree. There's enough that you can do that you don't have to go back and rehash and exactly start a whole new deal. And you got some quality talent. FTR, I'm happy that they officially turned them, that they're going to be heels now. Tully Blanchard, who was a great guest on our podcast, by the way, Jeff, about a year and a half ago, he's going to do a great job as a heel manager. You look at him and he looks more Tully-ish than he did 35 years ago when he was a top heel in the business. He just has that face. He's got that walk. I think we're going to see some really good stuff from them.
He's got such a natural resting bitch face.
<You know? laughs> Nice.
Like such an a-hole just standing there. And, you know, when he talked, you know, I mean, he did a great job taking the microphone from Ricky last week. And, you know, I kept waiting for them to finally do something with Tully. And I think it's going to be interesting, especially think about it. You know, if that does happen, then all of a sudden you have the Tully, you know, on one side, Arn on the other. And does that eventually come into play where you have Tully on one side and Arn on the other? You know, there's myriads of possibilities without actually reforming the fucking Horsemen. I mean, hell, as far as I'm concerned, the Bullet Club should be dead, because the Bullet Club they have out in Japan now, it's 3 or 4 years past its time. And I just wish, you know, different heel groups, you know, like what's next? Are we going to have somebody say, well, let's reunite and have Gary Hart's army reform? Well, you know, I'm sorry, Gary Hart isn't with us anymore, so it makes no sense. And, you know, that was, you know, 40 plus years ago. So why do we want to recapture something from 30 plus years ago that it was a great gimmick while it lasted? But there's a reason that it only lasted a certain amount. You know, everything has a shelf life, and people just don't fucking understand that very.
Yeah, and that's, you know, again, everything does have a shelf life, and everything evolves and everything moves on, which was where we started the whole conversation about AEW. And look, I know that there's a lot of people who listen to us that actually do like AEW as well. But yeah, trying to reform the Horsemen. The truth was, the last incarnation, when you look at it, it was Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit. And, you know, but I forget who the other members were.
Mongo?
I mean, okay, you know, that sucks. I mean, I was trying to make the point that, you know, you had some quality wrestlers and you got to
absolutely. Malenko and Benoit were fantastic wrestlers, but how the fuck Mongo got put in there? I guess that was the Lex Luger theory of, if he stands around watching great wrestlers, maybe he'll, by osmosis, he'll start to become good.
Didn't happen for Mongo. Mongo was terrible out of the gate. And I still, if you remember Jimmy Berkeley, the referee, we were talking about him a couple weeks back. He said something to me. He said two things to me. He said, one was, watch this kid, Kurt Angle. This guy's going to be a real superstar. And he was 100% on the money on that one. And he called it like from the first time he ever saw Kurt Angle. And he also said, watch this Mongo McMichael. He's going to be a real force in the business. And I still tease him about that one.
He's 1 out of 2 on that one.
Yes, he is. Batting 50%, right?
Exactly. So, all right, let me just, before we have the go home here, Barry, let me just talk about a couple things real quick. Wanted to, just because I thought it was a great story. Did you happen, and I don't know how big a baseball fan you are, did you catch the Marty Brenneman story from the other night? The announcer
catch that. Yes. Yes.
So, for those of you not aware, and it was a big story, made national news, Marty Brenneman, longtime voice of the Cincinnati Reds. I believe his dad might have been the voice of the Reds before that. His dad, was it Tom Brenneman? And I know the one thing that I know about Marty Brenneman is Marty Brenneman hates the Cubs. And so he takes a shot at the Cubs every chance he gets. So while I was not happy to see someone lose his job, that part of me, the Cubs fan part of me, was kind of happy to see him get his little comeuppance. So he does this bit where he throws it to a commercial, not realizing that he's got a hot mic there in front of him. Okay. And I'm going to bring up a story that involves a hot mic in a second. So he unfortunately, I think they were getting ready to go to Kansas City, and he makes a rather unfortunate comment about what he thinks about the city of Kansas City and what, in the opinion of Marty Brenneman, what Kansas City is known for. Got him in a little hot water. He basically was fired right there on the air or suspended at least by the Reds the day after his contract with Fox, as far as covering the NFL, was pretty much terminated. But what was great was after he came back from commercial, he tries to do some on-air apology, okay? And he's doing the on-air apology, and he's going, you know, this is not who I am. I'm not this kind of person. I'm a better person than that. Oh, and there goes a home run. And, right. Yeah, and I'm a Christian gentleman. I would, you know, just he stops in the middle of his apology to call a home run, which is just apparently wildly inappropriate. And he got a lot of crap from people about it. So what this brought to mind, Barry, was when I was in Broward County working at the courthouse. Yes, it's time for another courthouse story, folks. We had a judge who was a retired judge who came back and was covering what they call magistrate court. Magistrate court is, you know, when you're arrested and you you haven't had a chance to post the bond yet. And you see it all the time on the evening news. And there's the guy on camera, and the judge is, it's usually a split screen. And the judge is saying, OK, you've been charged with DUI. And your bond is $500, and, you know, they'll sit there and pass the paperwork over to the clerk, and they process it. And the guy either makes the bond or they set him for some in-custody hearing a couple days down the road. So so what happens is it's lunchtime at the Broward County Courthouse, and the judge in question is sitting there, and he's talking or chit-chatting at lunch. He might be having a sandwich, I don't know, talking with the prosecutor. And he and the prosecutor are the only two guys in the courtroom. Everybody else had gone to lunch, and they're just kind of shooting the shit about nothing in particular, when somehow the topic comes up of, I don't know if it had happened with a previous defendant or what, that had been charged with a burglary, okay? And the judge makes the comment to the prosecutor, something to the effect of, you know, anybody that comes before me in magistrate that has a burglary charge, and it's in my city, which of course Fort Lauderdale and Broward County have about 15 different suburbs where you can say, I live in Fort Lauderdale, and there's like Plantation, Tamarack, Hollywood, you know, all those kind of encompass Broward County and Fort Lauderdale. He said, you know, if anybody comes before me and they get a burglary in my town, I'm automatically upping the bond. So he's made it known that the bond's going up, whether, you know, he really thinks it's a great case or not. And soon afterwards, he was no longer doing magistrate court and had to find something else to do during the day. So as I said, Barry, on another board, and I'm saying it here, yeah, those hot mics, Barry, they'll get you every time.
Yeah, you know, good thing you and I have never said anything inappropriate when the mics are on here and we're actually recording. Though I'm sure Sweet Lou's got all the proof of this.
Oh, he's got a veritable bank of information.
Yeah, he does too.
They do get you. Comment we made about somebody, and we'll probably.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, Barry. Yeah.
So I'm not really familiar with, you know, Marty Brenneman, voice of Cincinnati. Am I correct? Yeah, I just, you know, other than knowing that he hated the Cubs and that he would make a shot, I had heard his name. I'd heard his father's name. But, you know, it sounds like it was an off the cuff comment between two friends. But at the same time, it doesn't excuse, you know, it just you just can't say that shit.
Lewis corrected us. It is Tom Brenneman. Marty is the dad. That gotcha. Is why he is Sweet Lou, the chef, correcting the announcers. How dare you? But kudos to Lou for correcting me on that. Go back absolutely. About 5 minutes ago, and all the people that are going, Bowdern, you idiot, you got the wrong Brenneman. So now we've corrected it. Go ahead.
No, but that's it. You know, everything you said is correct. So
you'd say I'm 100% correct. I appreciate it.
I'd say you're 100, as usual, Jeff. You are about 100.
We don't want to forget now at this point about our interview with our friend. The great William Sanderson, character actor extraordinaire. We had such a great time interviewing him. Barry, what do you say we go have a little chit-chat? Talk a little Blade Runner. Talk a little Deadwood. Talk a little Newhart. Let's go to our conversation with our friend William Sanderson. Well, on behalf of Barry and myself, I can say that we are truly honored to have one of our favorite character actors. Barry, once again, we're going Hollywood. Today, we are joined by William Sanderson, well known for his appearances on the Newhart show, well known for his appearance in Blade Runner, well known for his appearance in Deadwood. It's E.B. Farnham joining us, Barry. How cool is that?
This is a dream come true because, Jeff, you and I, especially in our generation, we grew up with this guy. We grew up watching him on the Newhart show. You have made it perfectly clear multiple times. Your favorite movie of all time is Blade Runner. One of your favorite television shows of all time is Deadwood. So the fact that we've got William Sanderson joining us, and Jeff, I just want to give a little plug too. I got William's book today, this morning, right around 10 o'clock in the morning. It's called Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. And in about 4.5 to 5 hours, I completely blew through this book cover to cover. I loved it. I did take some notes. Highly recommended. You can purchase this on Amazon. Jeff, I know you're getting your copy tomorrow. Big thumbs up for me. But William Sanderson, welcome to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry.
Oh, I just thank you. As I hope I said earlier off the air, it's an honor. And you all are in New York now?
So I'm in Philadelphia. This is Barry. Philadelphia. Jeff is in a town outside of Atlanta called Cumming, Georgia. And Chef Lou Kippelman, Sweet Lou, our executive producer, is based out in the San Francisco area. So we're all spread out.
I'm delighted to talk to you all. But when I heard New York, or Barry had been working in some bars, I said, well, you'll know those stories that I told. It's such an incredible place, as Philadelphia, San Francisco, everywhere else. But, you know, working till 4 a.m. in New York City and hanging out, you meet a lot of characters and a little dangerous at times. But you mentioned Newhart. I got the idea from a bum on the Bowery in New York picking lint off his hat and talking to himself. And I dressed with several layers of clothes and took a little bit of that to the West Coast to put into Larry, for what it's worth, Larry and my two brothers, Daryl. But forgive my long-windedness.
No, that's fine.
And
we encourage
you. Keep me on the track, please.
Somebody's got to keep us on track, William. So, yeah. But
let me just ask you, how did you first originally get into acting? You know, what was it that drew you to acting and wanting to make a career out of that?
Well, like I've heard a number of friends or peers say, there were a lot of pretty ladies around the theater. I happened to have been in law school the second year, and they were doing a production of Hair next door. And we didn't have any women in our law school class. And on a break, I'd wander over and hang out, and I said, wow. Then somehow one of the graduate students asked me to do a play over there. And the last year in law school, I did it. And then I got in a local theater in Memphis, which was a really good one, Memphis, Tennessee. But look, short answer is I stumbled into it. Graduated in law school, but never took the bar. Went straight to New York to bartend for Fridays, 63rd and 1st, I believe. And
which, isn't that the original Fridays?
Yeah. Alan Stillman, the owner, and right. He is a man I don't know how to thank, who took me from there to Tuesdays to Thursdays to O'Neill's Balloon. And forgive me to the audience if I'm boring them, but they were all fun places, and you might have 6 people or more a day come through looking for a job. And my friend said I was a dumb Southerner trying to make an honest dollar. I let him think that, but I was just trying to keep up in New York, you know.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, the first role that really I sort of identified you as becoming a great character actor was, of course, in Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. Do you have any memories of working on that set? And I guess I got to ask you, when you first got the role, was this something, of course, the film is based on the Philip K. Dick novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Is that something as the source material that the actors in that movie would have to read, or were you just given the regular movie script?
Well, I was given the script, luckily, but you said, did I have any memories? I still have nightmares. nightmares of inadequacy, I guess, like some famous Alec Guinness said in his autobiography, how could we have done it better? But the book, I took a chance and I hadn't read it. My first wife read it, but I didn't. And when Ridley Scott, the great director, asked me if I'd read it, I said, not yet, I think. And he said, I haven't either. I couldn't get through it. But luckily, he let me down easily, you know, because I'm sure there were a number of actors that went in there very prepared. But I thought it's just another job. I'd just come off something called Scared Straight, which is a CBS movie of the week based on the original, where they take the kids in prison.
Sure. Yeah, I remember those.
But what was wonderful is I didn't have to sit in a group with six people. I just went in a room with him, and he talked to me like a human being. And he would tell me during the shooting to do something I did when I read with him, and I didn't know what he's talking about. I didn't remember. He said, you know how you come up on the end of the sentences? Boy, I couldn't emulate what I did. I just talked. But he was great. Ridley was. And memories. One of you just asked me about memories. I got to force a quote. I have a lot of memories. They keep the wolf of insignificance away from the door. You know, we need our memories.
Oh, sure.
It is,
yeah,
nice to be in a cult film, and I'm very thankful to the gods.
Well, I have mentioned, you know, we are over 150 episodes in on this particular podcast. And on, geez, Barry, how many 10 to 20 occasions I've mentioned that Blade Runner is my favorite film of all time?
Well, you're still doing them and Blade Runner's over, so.
No, I know. J.F. Sebastian was just such a great character, and I really did appreciate that movie. And I'm sure that you have fans that tell you they loved your work, but that film in particular really held out some special significance for me. And I really did love it. And I just want to tell you how much, as a film fan, more than just a moviegoer, I really appreciated that and your role in that film.
Well, I thank you. I remember telling the producer, Michael Dealy, at the end, well, 6 months from now, I'll be thinking how I could have done it better. And he said, it's another Brit, he said, 6 months, 6 years. And now it's 30-something. But, I mean, I don't lie awake, or I don't flog and beat myself, but, you know, I was supposed to die on screen, and Rutger talked the director out of that because he wanted to keep his character more sympathetic, like we all do, often. So, you know, I've died a lot, so I thought I could do it well, but it turned out all right. And I miss Rutger. He was a great gentleman, and God bless him. I'm sorry he passed away.
Yeah. So, Barry, I think you have a question about one of your favorite films that William was in.
Actually, I do. But, Jeff, even before I get to that, so in reading the book today, one thing that impressed me about William, first off, how honest the book was. You were very honest about your life, some of the trouble that you had gotten into in your younger days. But you also discussed some of the women that you had worked with, as well as the women that you were either married or dated. And I got to tell you, I really wanted to see a picture of Argentina, which wasn't in the book, but I was hoping. But you lived out a dream from my aspect. You got to kiss Linda Hamilton when you guys were making Black Moon Rising.
Oh, I don't think just me. I think that a lot of people, she just is very warm. And well, I don't want to misspeak here. She was nothing but a great lady. I think she's a friend of my brother, Daryl, my other brother, Daryl, John Volstead. But she did kiss me flat on the lips. And I said to Tommy Lee, who co-starred in that movie, Black Moon Rising, why does she do that? And he said, well, because she doesn't like her husband. But now I don't know that. She damn sure didn't kiss me because she didn't like her husband. I think she's a lovely person and maybe getting ready to do another action hero. I haven't seen her. She'd probably say, William who? You know, yeah. But man, she's got a heck of a life.
Yeah, she absolutely does. So the movie that Jeff was referring to, so one of my favorite films, and it's arguably my top 5 or 10 comedies of all time, is Fletch. And you played that real estate agent, Jim Swarthout, who had two of the most vicious Doberman pinchers guarding his lot. But conspicuously absent, you really didn't talk about it in the book.
Well, my wife Sharon said to a friend, an old friend of mine, if you want to upset him, ask him about Fletch.
Oh.
So I didn't do much, you know, and I liked the director, Michael Ritchie, and Chevy Chase was sitting in the audition when I went in, and they said they liked me in Blade Runner, so I didn't have to do much. But Chevy wasn't the same, and it was not a very big role. It was fine, but I was coming off Newhart, and I thought I'll never get another film. And my agent said, well, you can do it if you want to. But I thank you. I love the film, Fletch. I love the book. When I was living in New York, I was much younger, or several years, and I wanted to play a certain role. By the time I got to L.A., I was too old. But I'm glad they're going to do a new Fletch, maybe a black actor. Now, I'm not sure, but Chevy probably missed my magic, to put it that way.
Well, William, let me ask you a question. I told my son-in-law that I was going to ask you this question.
Thank you for mentioning Fletch, though. I love that people ask.
Good, because I didn't want to upset you. Okay.
Oh no! There's nothing to brag about, you know.
What I was going to ask you, my son-in-law is a huge Batman fan. And as I was looking over your career, I noticed that you did the voice work of Dr. Carl Rossum on the Batman animated series. And before we started recording, I was talking about how as an actor in Hollywood, I would think that doing voice work would be something to be really rewarding, because you can, if you want, preserve your anonymity. It's easy for me to say anonymity, while at the same time you're getting steady. You know, you worked on the series for like 3 years. Did you enjoy doing the voice work on that series?
Yeah, because we had some stars and well-known people in Hollywood, and I thought, well, I'm sitting here with them. I mean, from Zimbalist and others, but I really did enjoy doing cartoons. They don't care so much how you look, so you don't have to shave or go in there, worry about that. And some of them, I made money, and I was very lucky, and voiceovers and books on tape. But I wish I had the energy to put, I'll try it out on you. I don't know. Do you think my book, those One Who's Hurt Barry, do you think it's worth me trying to put it on a book on tape or whatever it is?
Oh, absolutely. I would, because your voice also... Yeah, your voice is so unique, so distinctive. Absolutely.
It was an Achilles heel, and as I said in the book, and an asset at the same time. But, well, you know, we all like our voice, our own voice, actors. But anyway, thank you. I'm sure I interrupted you.
No, I actually agree with Barry.
I work on that show, and I just still get asked about it, you know.
Yeah, I agree with Barry. I think if you were considering doing it on your own book, that you have such a distinctive voice that I think it's something that would appeal definitely to your fans.
Well, I wish Lou would produce it. I'd win the lottery, because I know a man who wants to do it on the West Coast, but I don't have the energy to fly. So I got to thank you again for even mentioning Yes, I'm That Guy, because it's hard during the pandemic. It's all about promotion, you know. I probably put that in the book. They said Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, they asked the guy, he said, something bad happens when you don't promote. And he said, nothing. So thank you, guys.
P.T. Barnum, that's right.
I got a lot of non sequiturs, man. I think it's caused by one too many auditions, but I love your questions.
Oh, absolutely, too. And just once again, the book is called Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. It's about 300 pages. I couldn't put it down. I haven't even eaten lunch today because I was just skimming and going right through this book.
It is for you, William. That's what Barry did. He sacrificed.
Absolutely. Big sacrifices, but I loved it. So I have a question. You brought up.
I owe you. I don't know how I'll repay you, but I owe you.
So you brought up the name Tommy Lee Jones a little bit earlier. We were talking about Black Moon Rising. And Tommy Lee Jones is somebody that you've worked with 6 times, according to your book.
Yep.
And it sounds like the relationship it's a unique relationship. And I have to think a lot of that is based off of Tommy. You know, it's at times he's a big supporter of yours, but he sounds like a very complicated individual. Is that the right way to put that?
Yeah, as complex as any I've worked with, yet I love the chance to work with him. And I said to the man that directed him in Men in Black a couple of times, I think we have a love-hate relationship. And he said, aren't they all? But Tommy, only once he asked me after we did Lonesome Dove, I'm dropping names like a fool, but after we did that, he asked me to do the title role on a play. And certainly called The Authentic Life of Billy the Kid. And he's the best theater director I'd ever worked with. And, you know, I missed the chance because the director, Joel Schumacher, asked me to be in The Batman with Val Kilmer and Jim Carrey. And I was working, and the director, John Frankenheimer, wouldn't let me go. He said, well, when it rains, it pours. But sometimes Tommy would refer to another actor, a friend of mine, Tracy Walter, and recommend him. And I could talk about Tommy for days. You had to stop me. But the director said, I told Tommy Lee that, do you know who's in this movie? Because we'd done Coal Miner's Daughter together. And he said, the director told him it's William Sanderson. And he said, good, he won't have to talk. Because I played a deaf mute. And he, a mechanic, but he kept me from talking in the client, but I kept the money. And I love Tommy, and I don't know how it feels. I asked a man who wrote Lonesome Dove, I don't know if he likes me. And William Whitliff said, not Larry McMurtry, but William said, yeah, he does. He does. I'm sure he does. It's hard to know.
Well, if you work together six times, I would hope that he likes you a little bit.
Yeah, but he didn't know, like, he didn't know I was going to be in Coal Miners. He didn't know I was going to be in Executioner's Song, but he did send me a six-pack of beer because it's hard to, oh, hell, he had me in his dressing room eating chili, but he's a tough guy, you know. I played a guy that had a law degree in The Client, and I was very happy to shoot in my hometown of Memphis and have my wife there and a lot of other things happened. But he was afraid I was going to upstage him behind him. And he said, none of your bullshit. You know, I laughed. I didn't. You don't need. You got the part. Just play the part, you know. And I never. Other character actors have written about that. But just when it's your moment, you try to be good. And don't be too good when it's not. But Tommy, I admire. And I hope to find out someday. I hope he'll read the book. I don't know what he, you know, he's a Harvard graduate.
Oh, yeah.
with honors, and I'm barely got out of Memphis State, so we'll see. But it was a good school. It was a very good law school.
Well, I would be remiss, William, if I did not discuss your role as E.B. Farnham on the TV show Deadwood, which, of course, they did a movie recently to sort of wrap the story up. First of all, you know, your work, I love the interplay between you and the actor Ralph Richardson, who sort of worked for you in the hotel. And just amazing, you know, the chemistry between the two of you. And, you know, of course, then Ian McShane was so great on that show. Please, if you could share some memories of working on the set of Deadwood for us.
Well, Ian, first worked a couple of years before Ralph joined us, but Ian is a phenomenal actor, and if acting is reacting, you can't help but react in the scene. And I love him, love working with him. I don't want to leave out the man who created the roles for us, David Milch, but Ian, you had to be on your toes, to put it tritely. He had so many lines that he would paraphrase a lot, and who wouldn't, you know? But so you look for the cues, but I learned from him, and I don't think he trusted me for a while, but I think he does now. And in fact, he invited me to do a cameo in that show in Canada. He was doing American Gods, and that's about as big a compliment as you can get. But
yeah.
Ralph, he was an extra, and he didn't have a malicious bone in him, but he would distort the truth a little bit, tell David he's a great cook and he managed a restaurant. And Ralph passed away, unfortunately. But he's another one that was just super fun to work with. David whispered to me and said, "Do you think he understands a word we're saying?" But David takes your flaws and runs with them, mine or virtues in his case. And I thought Ralph, every time I looked at him, I thought he looked like a Shakespearean character, and I just loved working with him. But the whole cast, Timothy Oliphant was terrific, and Molly Parker, and Timothy, of course, played Sheriff Bullock, and most of them were based on real characters. Paula Malcolmson is great, and I can't list them all, but they were all terrific.
Gotcha.
So I've got this list. There was a website, which I don't know if it exists any longer, called toplessrobot.com. And about 7 or 8 years ago, they put out a list, the 10 nerdiest roles of William Sanderson, which I thought was great because I know that I'm a nerd. Jeff, would you say I'm a nerd?
Oh, yes, completely.
There you go. I'm definitely a nerd. And so I thought this was cool. And Jeff, you'll be happy to know, number one, J.F. Sebastian and Blade Runner. Your son-in-law will be happy to know, number four, Dr. Carl Rossum in Batman, the animated series. But one of my favorite roles of your career was Skeets in Rocketeer, working with Bill Campbell and working with the lovely Jennifer Connelly. But I love Rocketeer. I just thought it was
a beautiful lady. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm glad I made that list. And nerds, you don't sound like nerds to me, but how would I know?
That's how I tricked my wife into marrying me, right there. That's it.
I think nerds get lucky sometimes. I certainly did. And my wife, Sharon, contributed to the book. There wouldn't be any book without her, because I had many, many pages, but she remembered how we met in Vegas, and Ray helped too. Ray is an entertainment writer in Hollywood, and we had arguments, but he did more than stir the stew, which is what Newhart says his co-writer did. Anyway, I quit drinking to get the book finished, so I hope you don't know how grateful I am that you mention it.
So, Barry, why don't you again tell the folks how they can get William's book?
Yep. So, William does have a website that you can probably get it off of there. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. You can. What we're going to do is, if they want it, they can say so. We tell them how. But I think we will. You know, I feel like that guy that sells the pillows on TV all the time.
Let me mention, Barry, that the website William was referring to is williamsanderson.net. You can find out how to order it, or you can go to Amazon and get his book, Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor, by William Sanderson with Ray Richman.
Yeah, and Instagram, I just, especially during the pandemic, notwithstanding my narcissism or vanity, I was hoping you'd ask me why I wrote the book, and I'd just say that. Vanity, but
hey, William, why did you write the book?
Vanity? That is not the reason. Usually they don't persist. It's a good way to dig your own grave. In the book, I say I wanted to make my case in the court of posterity, but if they read the book, they can see why. I had about 15, 20 reasons to write it, 15, 20 not to write it. And, boy, that's a long answer for a short question. But I did get a promotion. My mother-in-law passed away. She left me a dog, my wife and I, and it's a Malty Poo. It's the cutest dog, but there's a picture of the dog and me on Instagram, actor_William_Sanderson.
Well, William, we're both big dog fans, so we're going to need to know what the name of the dog is.
The dog's name is Misha, and I'm told I got a promotion because I'm the dog walker now. She brings a lot of fun to us, though, you know.
Yeah. And I've told Jeff, and Jeff and I have talked about our dogs. I have a love affair with my dog. I'm so close to him. It drives me crazy. But I wanted to bring up, I know we've only got you for a limited time, and we certainly, we don't want to take up your entire day, but you made a movie, and it was the last movie of his career, the great John Candy. I am such a huge John Candy fan, and I was so devastated, which I think was 1994 when he passed away. I remember I was living in New York at the time, and I remember getting the news that he had passed away. But it was Wagons East, also starring another guy that always makes me laugh, which is Richard Lewis. Any memories of being on set?
Oh, yeah. He is just the sweetest man. He's the first one to congratulate Sharon and I on getting married, and he had some parties, and this was his third film in a row, and we were up high in the mountains, and of course he was overweight, and I think it was too much, but I got nothing to say but positive things. He's pleasant and fun to watch when he acted, and Richard Lewis even said something nice about my book, so we talk about him in the book. Maybe that's why I said it, but I'm just kidding. John, I couldn't say enough things nice about him, but I didn't become bosom buddies. I think my college roommate's famous final surgeon was supposed to see him about his back when the movie was over. He had a problem with his back, which I didn't know. I took the film because of him. The agent said, I don't want you to go. It's pilot season, and it's not a lot of money, and I got to work with him. Same thing happened with Robin.
Robin Williams. Too much.
Yeah, and another nice human being to me.
Well, listen, we just can't thank you enough for appearing on our show today. And, you know, both Barry and myself and Lou were just big fans of your works. I was just looking at your IMDb page, and I noticed that you were in an episode of The X-Files, which was one of my favorite shows at the time. And I didn't even realize that until I was going through your page.
But that one, that's a great director. I'm glad you noticed.
Chris Carter?
There were more jobs that didn't show up on IMDb, but I think it was called Blood or something, and that was a lot of fun. And David, I forget his name.
Duchovny.
He hired me for ER and so forth. But thank you for looking at the IMDb.
No, you've had such a wide and varied career, and we really do appreciate you appearing with us on the show today. Barry, any last comments for William?
Yeah, so and then we can definitely wrap it up. So I moved to New York. It was probably about a decade after you did, William. I worked at Tavern on the Green, and I lived 7 blocks away. I was on 74th between Central Park West and Columbus. And when I left Tavern on the Green, I went to work at O'Neill's Balloon and had the same owner as the Ginger Man. Yeah. Which was it Michael McNeil? Is that right?
Right. Mike was a younger brother. Patrick was the actor who
That's
passed
right.
away. His older brother.
Yeah. So Michael was the person I worked with. And I got to tell you, I was terrible. I will tell you, I was a terrible waiter. But Michael, for whatever reason, liked me. I guess I had this youthful enthusiasm. And he also, he had the Landmark Tavern, if I'm correct, and had the Boat Basin Cafe on the Hudson.
Right.
But he actually let me work in all those spots, and I was terrible. Why he didn't fire me, I'll never know. But when I was reading your book, I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, but you might be being modest if you were real and dealt with customers. And I imagine he was smart enough to see that. But, yeah, they saved me, those places. And then I worked in the Village, too, but some of them uptown wished that I'd stay in the Village, you know.
Right. Well, once again, we're going to give a plug for that book. It's Yes, I'm That Guy, The Rough and Tumble Life of a Character Actor. William, I think Jeff and I can go on record and say it, Jeff. We can say it. Sweet Lou, I think you would agree with us. William Sanderson is our absolute favorite character actor. Wouldn't that be correct, gentlemen?
I would have no problem saying that at all.
You all, no one's been this generous, so I'm going to go self-deceive myself. You know, there's a saying, and it's a terrible thing to say after you do that, but I made a producer laugh. I said, self-deception thrives in the compost of flattery. I take it honestly, and I really thank you. But I am that actress who couldn't see the line between what they wrote about her and who she really was. That's me by another name. So thank you, guys. Take care.
Thank you. How much fun was that, Barry? He was such a great and fun guest.
He was. And you know, you said it at the very top of the show, too. What a humble, easygoing guy he is. And you look at his body of work, and you know what? A lot of people are going to know him from Deadwood or from Blade Runner or Larry as Larry, Daryl, and Daryl. But, you know, you figure he's got another 100, you know, 100 listings on his resume. This guy has been working nonstop now for 40 something years and just the most humble, easygoing guy. So I think you're right. I think we've made a friend here. It's a friend of the show. And I want him to come back. I think that would be great.
And I know you have read his book. You said it was excellent. I have to tell you, believe it or not, Barry, I think I ordered the book from Amazon. I will not say our friends at Amazon, because here we're recording on a Monday at 6 o'clock. The book has still not yet arrived. So I wish I could say that I've read William Sanderson's book. Thanks, Amazon. No, I have not. So Barry, before we do the go home, want to mention a couple of birthdays, one very near and dear to your heart. One, not so much. Today, Barry, we have the 76th birthday of your friend, Rocky Johnson.
Yeah, that's another. And you know what? There was Rocky went through some, you know, he was not a perfect individual. And he took a beating in certain circles within the last year, and some of it possibly deserved, others not quite as deserved. But I always viewed Rocky, you know, he would at times call himself, he would call me his son. And I always viewed Rocky as a father figure in a lot of ways. And, you know, it was very, very difficult for me. Would you know, earlier this year when he passed away, it was sudden. I didn't expect it. And today would have been his birthday. So I actually reached out his wife and his ex-wife, because he was still on very good terms with his ex-wife, and just a message, you know, that I hope that everybody's doing well. But losing Rocky was definitely very, very tough. And it's hard to believe, you know, you go back, and I was the president as a young kayfaber. I was the president of the Rocky Johnson fan club back in the mid to late 70s. And, you know, it's so hard when the people that you idolize, when they die, you know, whether it's in, you know, and I think wrestling, there's such a deep connection. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that we got to meet we got to meet the wrestlers back in the old days. The beauty, again, Jeff, of the territory days, if I wanted to meet, and I saw this, I believe last night, but they were doing, I guess, Zoom meet and greets for WWE superstars, and it was like $120 or something. And that in a lot of ways is almost unconscionable to me that you could charge that kind of a price for an online meet and greet. But in the old days, you could go up to wrestlers and you could have converse for free. You could get autographs, photos, you know, it was never, nobody was charging.
Well, they were wrestlers, not superstars.
They were wrestlers. That's it. They were wrestlers. They were not superstars. And so part of it was, you know, if you idolized, and we as kids growing up, we all idolize somebody in some form, whether it's our own parents, our own father, or whether it's a movie or TV star, a musician, or an athlete. And for me, because wrestling was something that was, you know, again, I was able to see it twice a week live, but you were able to actually meet your idols. You know, it wasn't like you would watch them on TV and idolize them from afar. You were actually able to meet them. So it's very bizarre. It's a very odd feeling when they pass away, because you do have this deep emotional connection that supersedes watching somebody on TV or listening to music. And I felt the same way when Billy Robinson died, you know, 5-6 years ago. That was a very bizarre thing for me. And you know, God bless you. Both your parents are still alive. Both your parents doing well in their 90s, Jeff, at least your dad. I certainly don't want to age Mrs. Bowdrin anymore, but, you know, she's 30 and she looks fantastic, by the way. But, you know, I've lost both my parents. So you know, it's all just a bizarre, bizarre feeling. I don't know why I'm getting on this rant right now or this tangent.
Oh, I mean, but yes. I mean, you know, I can remember being maybe 13 or 14 years old when the first wrestling death that really affected me was when I picked up the Miami Herald one morning and saw that Bobby Shane had been killed in a plane crash. And, you know, I was absolutely, he was my favorite wrestler. The first wrestling match I ever went to. I've said this probably 20 times.
Yes, Savannah George.
Bobby Shane tag match. And, you know, so ever since then, even when he was a bad guy, he was my favorite wrestler, the king of wrestling, the original king of wrestling, Bobby Shane. And so, you know, and I never actually went up and met him, but I had that connection with him, like you said. Now, on the opposite end of the equation, birthday today for Vincent Kennedy McMahon, 75 years old today. I will say, Barry, that the spawn of hell himself, Vince McMahon, that people refer to these days, to me, the Vince that was the announcer in the 70s, I loved. I this is something I've mentioned before, too. I loved him as the over-the-top, bombastic play-by-play guy for the WWF shows that were at Madison Square Garden. I even loved him after they went national, his appearances on David Letterman. Oh, my God. If you've never seen Vince McMahon on David Letterman, do yourself a favor and go on YouTube and do a search and find those appearances. The New Year's Eve appearance with Vince and I want to say Bob Costas, where one was in one hospital. Yes. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And Vince was in one hospital. Bob Costas was in the other one. And they were waiting to welcome the first baby born in New York City. And, oh, my God, you talk about over the top. Letterman was screaming laughing because Vince was so over the top. And it was just crazy. But certainly the Vince that has come along that's charging people, you know, $120 for a Zoom meet and greet. The guy that's, you know, just heartless in so many occasions. That with this COVID crisis has been cutting jobs. Yeah, there's like two different people, Barry.
And making a lot of money while he's doing it.
Oh, yeah.
As well, and I think that was my contention was that, you know, apparently he was able to pocket. And I understand it. Look, business will be business. But again, I'm not blind to the fact that if Vince didn't do it, that somebody else would have done it. And the truth was business is business. Vince killing the territories, if you want to say Vince did, Vince had an opportunity to take wrestling to the next level. And you really can't fault him for that. I can't, you know, look, you may have helped, you know, kill CWF, which was already on its way to death. But at the same time, it's what business is. He had to. But there have been a lot of decisions and a lot of allegations over the last 35 years of some really horrific behavior. You know, we were talking about this a month or so ago, and we basically said Vince has got an autobiography coming out next year. I believe that with that autobiography going to be released, you're going to see people dig as much dirt as humanly possible on Vince McMahon. And I think you're going to see some stuff uncovered that's been mumbled about privately for the last couple of decades, and deservedly so, because if even 20% of some of these allegations are true and they're found to be truthful, I think he'll have to step down from the WWE. And to that end, I think that's the best thing that could happen to the WWE right now.
To quote Bette Midler, and Barry, let me say that I think Bette this is the Midler? First time I've ever quoted Bette Midler on this show.
No,
mud will be flung tonight when that book comes out, Barry. I don't think there's any question about that. So on that note, are you about ready for the go home?
Yeah, this is a
Barry,
great
I have
show.
One last thing to mention. I okay. saved this for the end of the show. I have mentioned over the last, maybe two or three episodes, problems with a blockage in my ear. You recall that, Bear?
Oh, absolutely. I recall it.
Well, so I went to the old doctor and not my oncologist. I went back to my regular primary physician. The one who originally had diagnosed me with the lymphoma. So I explained to her, I said, oh, I got this little problem. I blocked. Oh, let me take a look. She goes over, shines the light into my ear. And her words were, Barry, and I quote, oh, yeah, I see what the problem is right here. And that is when you know that you have some waxy buildup. Let's just put it that way, folks. I would just encourage you the next time you go for a physical, perhaps ask your doctor to check for your ears, to check. I mentioned to a friend of mine, and she said, oh, no, every year I go and have them check my ears. So that will become my legacy, much like Ethiopian food is your legacy, Barry. Waxy buildup in the ear is my legacy. For my co-host, Barry Rose, and for our producer, Sweet Lou Kippenman, I remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. I'm sure Brian Last, very proud now of my waxy buildup story. For the Arcadian Network. And until next week, as we get one episode closer to the Hall of Fame episode.